Hello and welcome to Culture with me, Robert Bound, where today we're taking a sneak peek behind the culture pages of Monocle's April issue. The stories we've picked to unwrap on today's show take us on a winding journey through Asia, from the bookshops of Shanghai and Nanjing to a photography exhibition in Kyoto, and we'll end with the beautiful people of the Wonderfruit Festival in Thailand. It's a bumper issue and not to be missed, so delve into Monocle with me, Robert Bound, today on Culture. Our first stop, as advertised, is in China. Our Shanghai correspondent, Justin Bergman, travelled to various cities around the country to meet the people behind its best bookshops and to discuss the state of the Chinese publishing industry, as well as the international publishing industry in China. And Justin joins me on the line now. Justin, welcome to the programme. Nice to have you with us. And first of all, when we were chatting about this, doing this story on the phone back and forth a little bit, we kind of had this feeling, didn't we, the both of us, that we've been down as a magazine and generally in the West, we've been down on Chinese bookshops, and we wanted to kind of tell the story of their resurgence. Is that fair for us to say? What was the state of them in the old days?
Well, I don't think that we were the only ones down on it. I think that a lot of people in China were also down on their bookstores for a really long time. I mean, when I first arrived here in 1999, the bookstores were quite bad. I mean, the state-run bookstores were just really grim affairs, were badly lit, really functional places where you would just go to pick up a book and leave. There was nowhere to sit. There was nowhere to have a coffee. And so what's surprising is that that's really changed with all of these new independently run bookstores. They're really looking different and going for a totally different kind of feel and design.
And is there a kind of design aesthetic? Do you think that they've packed their suitcases and gone on some kind of fact-finding missions, that the Chinese bookstore owners? We talked about wonderful bookshops in Taiwan and in Japan particularly. There's obviously wonderful small chains here in the UK, or one in particular. Where have they been doing their fact-finding, do you think, Justin?
I think these bookstore owners are really savvy. I mean, they didn't just get into the market overnight. They've been bookstore owners, a lot of them, for many, many years. So they love books. They've done their research. They've gone overseas. They've looked at Taiwan. They've looked at Japan, at the UK, at the US. And they brought back a lot of these ideas. So I visited three individual bookstores in three different cities to kind of get a survey of the market and what they look like. One was in Nanjing, one was in Hangzhou, and one was in Shanghai. And each of them, I was surprised, had really different aesthetics and different kind of viewpoints about what they thought a bookstore should look like. And the main thing I think they were really doing differently is really creating unique spaces. I think that was one of the big priorities, to bring young people back to bookstores especially. And a good example of this was in Nanjing, the bookstore run by the company, it's called Librairie Avant-Garde, quite a name. But they renovated an underground parking garage, a huge space, and did it in a really unique way. You know, they built the bookstore on the ramp that went between the old parking levels. The old parking lines were still on the floors, and it didn't have this cold, you know, kind of parking garage feel to it. They actually made it feel very warm and cozy, with lots of places to sit and read a book.
People reading your story in the magazine, Justin, will see that these are all three very sort of independent spaces, aren't they? One of whom, which is a very kind of interesting kind of business model and a big deal, is Zhong Shuge. You visited the one in Guangzhou. Tell us a bit about the person behind that company, because that is the sort of thing that I can imagine there is a sort of dearth of Chinese brands that make it overseas. I wonder if this bookshop chain, Zhong Shuge, could be one. Tell us a little bit about the story behind that one.
Originally, this founder was a professor. He was a teacher and spent many years teaching, and decided he wanted to devote his life to bookstores. So he quit. And this was many years ago. I want to say, you know, maybe almost 20 years ago, he opened his first bookstore. But his business, as with many bookstores in China, around, you know, 5-6 years ago, there was a huge problem with these bookstores going out of business. And the main reason was online competition. They just couldn't compete with the low prices that online retailers were selling books. So this owner, John Shuga, kind of had a think about it. And he said, you know what, I need to do something different. And his idea was to really just create a totally different design that you wouldn't find anywhere else. And so his bookstore in Hangzhou is quite theatrical looking. He's covered the ceilings with mirrors and put mirrors on all the walls. So when you walk in, it gives the impression that the bookshelves go on forever into infinity. And he's created bookshelves that make that look like trees to kind of resemble the nature in Hangzhou. So you walk into some of these rooms and you just are surrounded by a rainbow of colorful book spines, which, you know, obviously young people here love because it's totally something they can share online with their friends, take pictures. But, you know, the more I spent time in these places, I also realized that people were drawn to the spaces not just to share pictures of it, but they, you know, they really wanted to spend time in these spaces, reading books, having a coffee, and just kind of being in the moment.
Yeah, I mean, those pictures look great in the magazine. And it is a place. I mean, you know, books are supposed to be that thing. They are supposed to be akin to a tree, aren't they? There's as much beneath the surface as there is on top. It's not a bad metaphor for the owner of Zhong Shuge to run with in his stores. Let's talk a little bit about, you know, we sometimes unfairly feel that there is a sort of heavy hand of the government in some of Chinese, what appears to be independent Chinese enterprise. So tell me just how independent you think these shops are, Justin, and if the government is supporting them, why is it doing it now?
To be honest, it is a little bit of a murky scenario in China, as you would expect. These bookstores are completely independently owned. These owners, you know, they're not controlled by the government. However, they do receive some funding and subsidies from the government. And this, you know, goes back a few years in China when Xi Jinping made kind of a big decision and decided that reading he wanted to promote as a healthy hobby. And so he was going to, from the top down, he wanted all of the party leaders to fall in line, start reading more, and as part of the next five-year plan, which we're currently in, create a country of quote-unquote avid readers. That was one of the main goals in this five-year plan. So as part of that, the government started spending money on promoting and really supporting these independent bookshops like they never had before. So what that means is a lot of them receive discounts on rent, they get tax breaks, and they do receive some direct subsidies. We're not talking about large amounts of money here. I kind of asked this question to all of them, and they said it was really more of like a yearly supplement of their income for the best performing bookstores, kind of like a reward situation. And, you know, my next question immediately was, well, do they have any control over you, you know, given this money, given this help that they're giving? And, you know, to the one, each one said that they really don't, that they're free to make decisions about the types of books they stock, how they decide how their bookstores look and feel and everything. So, you know, in China, there obviously is censorship. That's not something you can get away from. But for the bookstores, that wasn't a huge concern. Censorship here typically happens in the publishing stage. If there's a sensitive book that wants to get published in China, it has to go through the publishers. You know, the Chinese government controls the publishers quite directly. This is a big way that they control the message getting into the country.
So essentially these bookshops can sell all the books that are made. It's just that sometimes books aren't made, I suppose, is the best way of saying it.
Yeah, that's right. Like they'll be able to sell whichever books are approved by the government and able to be published in Chinese. So what happens with the publishers is that they'll decide if a book is too sensitive, it just won't make the cut, or that they'll take, say, a foreign translation, an American book, and tell the American publisher which parts need to be cut in order to be published in Chinese. And a lot of foreign writers don't agree to this. They just decide not to publish in China. One of the big problems with Chinese authors is obviously self-censorship. They know what's not going to make it past the censors, so they just don't write anything sensitive. But like I said, for the bookshops themselves, they're not really in the position of rejecting books outright. The only situation where they do have some problems is getting foreign magazines and foreign publications that aren't translated, that are in English or whatever language. And in that case, you know, those have to go through what one of the bookstore owners called me a very strict border control process.
Well, it's an interesting thing. You mentioned magazines there. Your story appeared, you know, in our magazine. Justin, how easy is it? And we know that it's a little less easy than it was, in fact, to buy Monocle, for example, in China and in Hong Kong, even because of the sort of commodifying of a lot of these magazine stores as well. One person tends to own a lot of these stores, and the independence seems to be dying out. What about the health of the magazine market and being able to buy overseas magazines?
Well, yeah, it's not really as robust as it could be yet, but there are promising signs. For instance, the big chain called Fang Sua, which is one of the three that I visited, has a Shanghai outpost, and this shop is actually called The Mix Place. And it has an entire floor devoted to magazines, which was really amazing to see in this city, because you really, you know, haven't seen this very much in the past. Even at airports, you don't have a huge selection of foreign magazines in China. So what they have is a really incredible array of mostly, I'd say, design, food, travel, literary magazines from all over the globe, you know, Europe, the US, Japan. But what I really was encouraged to see what a selection they had in this shop. And that can only point to this continuing in a positive direction in the future.
This was an interesting story to put together. As I said, it came off so wonderfully well on the page. When you went to these bookshops and you interviewed the owners and the managers of it and some of the people that were, you know, some of the punters, were they surprised that you were doing a story on this? Or did they say, oh, about time, you know, we've wanted to tell our story, you know? And did you get the full kind of service treatment from people wanting to tell a good news story as they saw it?
Absolutely. That's one of the things that we like to do in China as writers, is to showcase some of the positive things happening here. And absolutely, from a design standpoint, I think that these owners are really proud that they've made spaces that are not just published in this magazine, but are published on design websites and get attention for the way that they look. And, you know, there's been a lot of people complaining about China, you know, obviously for obvious reasons, just copying concepts from the West and designs from the West. You know, these bookstores have their own feel. Like they, you know, you might be able to say that this could be anywhere in the world, really. For instance, the one in Shanghai had a really lovely feel to it. It had creaky old floors. It had jazz music playing in the background, and they actually sold a huge selection of hard to find vintage jazz records. And they made use of old Shanghai furniture, put these old pieces of furniture in the bookshelves themselves, and then put books inside these like old cabinets and things. So it was a really, you know, unique way to use the space. And yeah, I did get the sense that they were really feeling like, oh, it's about time you showcase this.
Well, it's a good way of getting some points on your loyalty card for all those different bookstores, Justin. It's a wonderful story. It's called A New Chapter. Possibly unsurprisingly, Justin Bergman is the writer, an illuminating and elegant writer, of course he is. It's in the April issue of Monocle. Justin Bergman on the line from Shanghai. Thank you very much. Next up, Japan. Sophie Hébrard is a French photographer whose work spans artistic, editorial and commercial endeavours. In the past, for Monocle, she came with me to the beer-fueled pop extravaganza in Dortmund, Germany, that was Schlagerboom, and shot a beautiful photo essay for us. But in the current issue, Hébrard has become the focus of one of our articles. She has an exhibition that's just wrapped up in Amsterdam and is now travelling to Kyoto. It consists of a series of photos that show love and tenderness within the unlikely realm of pornography, an industry that's infamous for the opposite. Here is Sophie Hébrard.
I was very interested into doing a project about sexuality and mostly the human body. And I didn't really think that it was appropriate to ask my friend if I could take pictures of them naked. So as a result, I went to a swingers party, which I thought that was the best place for me to meet people. And so I went there, and that night, as it was fate, I met porn director Gazman. And we got on really well, and he invited me to one of his sets, which was about 2 weeks later. And he said, come and have a look. You know, maybe you'll find what you're looking for. So that was the beginning of the project.
People will be Googling you and looking up your work as we're talking here on the radio, Sophie. So people will be able to see the wonderful life and character and I suppose a sense of honesty that you get from your subjects. When you're not looking your subjects in the eye, when you're looking at them from over their shoulder or you're looking at them doing their work, and this is an unusual job, in the porn industry. How do you tease out the truth? Are you searching for something and you find a picture to frame it, or do you take a picture and then reason it afterwards?
I think I always try to work with my gut feeling. You know, when I press the shutter and there's an emotion, it's mostly because I feel something and I feel that, you know, the viewer will feel that same way. But I guess I'm always trying to find the beauty everywhere I am. So that's also why I think It's Just Love was so successful, is because it's not necessarily, you know, a world where you're imagining a lot of beauty and also, you know, the human side of it. And for some reason, I think my eye is very naive. So, you know, if you Google my work, you will see that, you know, I don't do porn for a living. And I have, you know, I shoot mostly families or kids, or, you know, I go to remote places like Cape Verde and shoot the people there. But wherever I am, wherever it is, even if it's a bit of a bleak place, I always manage to find the beauty. I think it's just my eye that is trained like that.
And is this a bit of a campaign of yours, that you want to find beauty in places where it might be disguised, or it might be unlikely, or it might be unusual? As you say, you don't always shoot in the most auspicious places. Some places are classic and they're beautiful, and we can see very obviously what that is. But is it a bit of a campaign of yours, in a way, to make the ugly or the unlikely beautiful with your lens?
Yeah, I guess so. But, you know, I feel like I almost discovered that after shooting it. It was not something that I was aware of before I went shooting on porn set. But the truth is, when I came back and I had all these really beautiful images, yeah, it really, you know, actually, I really realized what my eye was trained to, and I really realized almost who I was.
Now, I mentioned in the introduction, Sophie, that this show, It's Just Love, it premiered in Amsterdam, and now it is moving, it is showing in Kyoto as part of an art and photography festival. Have you canvassed opinion? I mean, we think of Kyoto as the city of the Golden Temple and beautifully tended gardens and a certain kind of tradition and nostalgia about it. Do you have an idea of how the show will go down in Kyoto? Do you want to make people look twice, three times, four times at these pictures, against the context of this particular city?
Yeah, you're right. It's quite an unusual city to have an exhibition about porn. But, you know, in Amsterdam, it was the same. When I exhibited, I didn't want to make it into a blank space. I didn't want it to be in a gallery. So what I did is I worked with a set designer and we reorganized the space to make it really beautiful. And I really don't want to shock people in any way. So it's really for them to take another look at porn and see something different, see the beauty and the humanity. And so I think, you know, for It's Just Love Kyoto, we're doing the same. So we're doing a big set design. We're building walls and putting up wallpaper and lots of beautiful things in it. And so hopefully it will be the same result as in Amsterdam. You know, people from all age came to the show and I don't think anybody was shocked about it.
And just finally, I wondered about the different mindsets that you have for doing your commercial work. You've done large campaigns for well-known brands and worked with advertising and creative agencies, as well as working for magazines such as ours. I suppose commercial work is a lot of setting up, and editorial work is presumably looking for things. But how do you approach those things? Do you wake up on the morning of a big shoot for a magazine or for a brand and feel like a different person getting out of bed in the morning?
I think I approach it a little bit the same way. But so you're right, you know, for advertising campaign, everything is set. But then you have to just forget about why you were here and who brought you here and all the constraints that you've heard in meetings and stuff, and just go for finding the best picture. You know, that's what I do. And that's what I've been doing since I've started doing commercial work, is when I do something, when I work on something, I always try to make sure that I get the best picture for me and for the client. And so that, you know, involves a number of things that I do. But, you know, this is really that. It's really trying to just forget about everything. And same as when I'm on a porn set, you know, just trying to find that moment where your heart skips a little bit and you're like, oh, you know, I like this shot. And when you've pressed the shutter. So, yeah, that's what I try to do.
And one of the other pieces of work in your portfolio is the Dunk Elite. You're in New York City shooting these dudes practicing basketball, practicing getting hoops in basketball. It's an amazing, beguiling sort of photo essay, Sophie. I wondered how, and they're really charming blokes that I think probably took a little bit of persuading to be as relaxed in a very male environment with the lens in their face, or even far away from them on the court, but, you know, documenting every move they make and all the rest of it. How quickly do you make friends with your subjects? Sometimes it feels like there's such an intensity in your work that it must be tough to pull yourself away from your subject sometimes.
It's always hard to find the right balance. Also, you know, you're right. I come here with the lens sometimes really in front of their eyes, and I think, you know, I'm actually really lucky because I'm a woman, and as a woman, I think you can do a lot more things that if I was, you know, a big bloke coming to see those guys and starting to take pictures of them. I think people, you know, allow me a lot more to get into the space. So it's true, when I was on the court, you know, I was just going to see people and just taking pictures of them without asking them. And some people saw me doing that and they were like, oh my God, this was amazing to see you, you know, evolving and getting the shots, because you were just, you know, nimble and was going to people without fear. That's what I like doing. I feel sometimes that I'm a bit of a chameleon. I like exploring places where I don't belong. In a way, that's where I also get my rush. I really like this. It feels like the most remote it is for me, the more pleasure I take in taking the picture.
Sophie Hébrard there, the photographer behind It's Just Love, which is on at the Kyotography Festival in Kyoto from the 14th of April until the 14th of May. Now, to end the show, we're going to turn the tables and I'm going to get a grilling about a story I did for this issue, a report from the music festival Wonderfruit. It's a carbon-neutral, hyper-fun, drop-dead gorgeous festival in the Thai countryside. And Henry Rhys Sheridan sat down with me in the studio a little earlier to find out all about it. Rocket, 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 me Elohim. Rocket, 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 me Elohim. Rocket, 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 me Elohim. Rocket, 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 rocket. Let's begin with, what is Wonderfruit? Wonderfruit is a festival in Thailand that this year was its third year. So it's a thing that's in its infancy. And you know, like all things in their infancy, when they're very young, you have no interest in them. But then when they're about the age of three, they start to have personalities. So that's when I went out to visit it.
Got it.
Bought it, you know, like a little blue jumpsuit and all the rest of it. Tickled its toes, chucked it under the chin, did many other things besides.
And tell me a little bit about the guy behind it, because I know that he's a scion of Thai industry, isn't he? Would it be fair to describe him as a trustafarian, or would that be doing him a disservice?
I think you might have hit the nail on the head. He kind of might be. He's a very charming... Let's first of all say he's a very charming man, an endlessly energetic man.
What's his name?
So he's called Pete to his friends. He has a long and exclusively interesting, wonderful Thai name. I'm not going to try and butcher it on the airwaves. Thailand is one of those places where you really need to have learned a little bit of the language, I think, to actually...
Do justice to any of it, no matter how small.
I know. Right. So I'm not. So he's Pete to his pals. We shot him for this story. He's the founder of this festival. As you say, he's I think he's possibly the heir to a fortune. Siam Motors in Bangkok sold a lot of cars and tractors and all sorts of sort of agricultural goods, machinery and all the rest of it. Rather than be restricted to the ball and chain of the boardroom, he's taken it out and he's set this thing up. I think this land that the Wonderfruit Festival takes place on, it's 40 miles inland from the flesh pot of Pattaya. You don't need to really necessarily have that in your thoughts as you go dancing around these rather lovely fields of Chonburi, which is where it's set. But the land is in his family as well, so anything goes.
This may be obvious to readers who have already received a copy of the latest Monocle, but why did you decide to make this story a photo expo?
We found some unbelievably beautiful people here. It's a very stylish festival. People come and they really go for it. To give listeners an idea of the of what it looks like, it is somewhere between the Burning Man Festival and something like the Secret Garden Party here in the UK. So there is something exclusive and there is something very hippie-ish about it. But at the same time, it's happening in Thailand. So you have a lot of, you have a very international crowd of people, expats. When we think of expats, we think of Aussies and Americans and Brits who maybe work in insurance in Hong Kong, coming and having a big fat party in the Thai countryside. But there's expats as well, a lot of Asian expats from Indonesia, from Malaysia, from all over the region who come to have a great time. Everyone takes such a huge, makes such a huge effort with their dress. Lots of the people I happen to kind of come across are sort of a costume designers and personal shoppers for people in Bangkok and all the rest of it. So there's an amazing mix of kind of style people, of fashion people, of music lovers, of people that just heard through the grapevine that it was a great party for the last 2 years and kind of and booked their tickets.
Now, it's not strictly a music festival. Tell me a little bit about the range of activities that were on offer. And I do want you specifically to mention the rice temple.
Okay.
If at all possible.
Well, you know the way of these things, Henry, is that lots of things that are sort of, the vibe is generally that they are a music festival. Like the Glastonbury Festival was called the Glastonbury Festival of Performing Arts and all the rest of it. And people now like to take the weight off the big acts that they have playing and give a lot of room to the things that are on in the daytime, to the things that might wake you up in the morning, to more of the holistic goodness, the yoga retreats and the kind of the gong baths, which also makes it into the copy, and a lot more of the kind of spiritual non-party stuff. So I'll tell you about the rice temple. This is an amazing thing. So there are 8 stages. One of them, there's only one that is shipped in from overseas. The first person, in fact, I met at the festival who turned around when he heard my British accent and he goes, "Ah, you what are you doing here at the festival? You come all the way from England to go dancing?" I was like, "Well, actually, I'm going to go dancing and I'm going to write about what it was like to go dancing here." He's like, "Sounds great. The name's Lightning." And I felt very ashamed of just being called Robert. You know, anyway, he built the only stage that is shipped in. It's called the Solar Stage. And he and his missus and his best mate are the people that are some of the originators of the Burning Man Festival. But one of the homegrown festivals, literally and metaphorically, homegrown stages is the Rice Stage. It's done out like a Wat Phra Singh kind of classic, beautiful Thai temple. And it's all made entirely in rice. And then at the end of the festival on the Monday, as everyone's clearing up and scratching their head and wondering where they left their car keys and many other things besides, maybe a small part of their brains, they eat in a sort of a sacrament, this rice temple. And it's the size of a temple, by the way. This is no little float that wafts around and looks nice in photographs. People play under this thing. And yeah, I didn't make it actually to the feast, but I certainly danced around in it the night before.
Did you manage to reserve any of your metropolitan cynicism when you encountered some of the more, shall we say, snake oily practices that were going on at the festival? Or did you find yourself able to give yourself over completely to the vibe there?
It's a really good question. I almost wrote a paragraph about this in the story itself, about how much of your London metropolitan self to leave behind at the entrance gate. And of course you go and you start writing things down, and as the weekend wears on and you become accustomed to making friends with the strangest people at the strangest times of day and night, and you become festivalized, like people become citified very quickly. And so it happens. The snake oily practices are sort of few and far between. Essentially, festivals are all about good vibes, so you have to give yourself up to them. And in Thailand, the country runs on good vibes, or at least in certain parts of it. Maybe outside of Bangkok, it seems to especially. So you kind of take that. You have to kind of, you take a bit of the Thai pill and just go dancing. And if you want to find out more about my wonderful trip to Wonderfruit, then head to the culture pages of Monocle's April edition. Here you'll also find features on the state of Italian TV this season, the innovative New York art dealer Elizabeth D, and a picturesque trip to Palm Springs Modernism Week. And a beautiful one that is too. That brings us to the end of today's show. You've been listening to Culture. My producer was the original Wonderfruit, Holly Fisher. Join me again at the same time next week. But for the time being, I've been Robert Bound, and thank you very much for tuning in.